Okay, this is 23rd August 1973, and I'm in Enschede talking with Professor Lex Mueller about early Dutch radio astronomy. Well, first of all, tell me just a little bit about your background. I assume you were trained as an engineer.
I was trained as an engineer in physics, really. We have a training courses here too in this university on physics engineering, you could call that. It was a sort of very broad engineering education. You had to do with a lot of fields. And I got into this radio astronomy business rather by accident, I think. I had started my studies in 41, which was during the war. And
at which university?
That was at Delft.
At Delft.
Delft Technical University. And I had to stop that after slightly more than a year, 1.5 years, because difficulties with the German occupation. And I was finally was sent to Germany, and I spent 2 years there at a factory.
You were caught in other words.
Working in metallurgy, really quite a different field. But that gave me the feeling when I came back that I didn't want to go into a large factory again. So that's
right.
Why. So at the end of my studies, I was not interested in much in going to Philips or something like that, or into the Shell business. So I was looking for something different, might be university or so. And then Professor Kronig, one of the well-known physicists, and he was a professor in Delft, he mentioned to me that there was a group of radio astronomers who wanted to astronomers at that time, of course,
yeah.
No talk about radio astronomy yet.
Right.
But really, this group of astronomers, they were looking for a young engineer to build receivers for them. Well, and,
let me just ask about.
Yeah.
I've heard stories about the Germans sending people up to the factories, but how were their students at all at universities, if that were true? Were these only students that were unsuitable for?
No, you see, we had to. At a given moment, I think that was in 40, must have been beginning of 43, I think. Then we had to sign a statement of loyalty to the Germans, or that we should not do anything against them. And that was drawn into a political affair, we shouldn't do that at all. So. Most of the universities, only a very minor group really signed the statement. And I was living at home at that time in Zeist near Utrecht, and I was in contact with students from the Utrecht University, and so I didn't sign. But then a couple of months later, the Germans decreed that all the students who hadn't signed should be assembled in a camp.
I see.
In the Ommen camp, and then and I went there. So some went underground, and others.
Right.
Well, my parents didn't like that quite. So I said, "You better go." So I went,
right.
And then we were transported into Germany.
So this effectively closed all the universities at this time.
Yes, they closed all the universities.
Right.
And
it wasn't only Leiden. I've heard of
no,
that.
No. They closed the entire thing. Yes.
Yeah.
Not straight away, I think, but it really amounts to that.
Okay.
So that done.
But I detracted you.
Yes.
So
yes. Right.
You heard about they wanted someone to build receivers.
Yes, build receivers, and they were talking at that time. There was a mistake in the advertisement. It was funny because I understood it was going to be at the Dutch coast somewhere near about Leiden or so.
Yeah.
But that was wrong, and finally turned out to be at Kootwijk. And so I applied for that position, and. It took quite a couple of months before they had decided there were the candidates as well, but they finally decided I was going to be there.
And when was this?
That was at the end of 1950. I had finished my studies
in
July 50, and then I think 1st of December 1950 I came into the foundation. Foundation at that time, I think it started in 1948 formally.
I see.
And there had already been one man, someone from Chinese Indonesian origin, Mr. Ho. He had been there and working already on a receiver, but it didn't go too well, and he was working there in a sort of wooden shed, and things were, I later heard, was some of a mess, and he ended up by burning the whole thing.
Was this before you arrived?
Before I arrived, yes. I don't know exactly when, but probably in the beginning of 1950 or so. But
I was hoping I could get a first-hand account of this fire from you, so I can't really get a first-hand.
No, but probably if you contact Mr. Van der Pol from the post office, he was in the Voogd's group that I mentioned earlier, that post office radio astronomy group. He probably is one of the people who really can give you a first-hand account of that fire.
But they were working on a 21-centimeter receiver.
They were working
before
on
you.
A 21-centimeter receiver, but the whole thing was burned, and there was nothing at the time that that I arrived. The only thing that was going on was that at Philips, Dr. Stumpers, who was one of the members of the board, the foundation, in his group was building some receiver components for me. So when I arrived, I got a few pieces of IF equipment, a preliminary mixer, I think a piece of antenna already, and some power supplies. That's what it more or less amounted to.
Right.
So a sort of crystal mixer, straight total power receiver with some power supply.
Now, as you know, it was the entire effort in the foundation before then to build a line receiver. There was no interest in the continuum?
There was no interest in the continuum at all. This receiver that I was to build was meant to go in for H-line work. That was really the thing that Oort was interested in, not continuum at that time.
And there was no research done before the foundation was formed in 1948. It was thinking in Oort's mind, I think. But
yes, there had been that colloquium about.
Yeah, certainly.
And at that colloquium, I think he came to the conclusion we needed a large telescope for that. And well, then the country was in a mess right after the war. So, and then I think he spent his time really on trying to get the various universities cooperating in a joint scheme instead of having their own schemes, each one. And I think he succeeded. And then he also borrowed one of those Würzburg antennas from Mr. De Voogd, who was the chief of that post office group. De Voogd was an electrical engineer. He was one of the directors in the post office. And he was interested in ionospheric research, and what he really was interested in it was the solar reception and getting and he was doing that well somewhat subversively within the post office, you could say, using his group for doing some of these things.
It was not an official program.
It was not an official program very much. Yeah. It was really his personal interest. But he argued that perhaps through radio astronomy you should get some warnings for certain fade outs and so on. And that was how he could do it. But,
exactly. So he actually was observing the sun. Not front rate.
He was observing.
Not for research.
He was observing the sun with Yagi arrays and so on. But there, I think that Van der Pol, for instance, who was involved in that work, he's a technical assistant really in the post office, and he's still there at Kotwijk. So he probably can tell you a lot about the time before I came there.
Right. Okay. Now back to 1950.
So, and then I had to consider the problem of building a 21-centimeter receiver, and I looked at the equipment, and I started thinking. I think I first went through the problem of what sort of stability I could get out of that equipment I got from Philips, and it was very poor, because no special measures had been taken in that equipment at all to really stabilize the thing. It was just ordinary power supplies with a line stabilizer in front of it, and that sort of thing, and that wasn't very good at all. At the same time, van der Hulst was in the States, and he was at Harvard, and I heard from him that Ewan and Purcell were working on equipment for the line receiver, and from him I only mentioned in a name that they were using a switching scheme, the switching frequency. So I got that idea, which didn't come from myself, but really comes from the Purcell group. Mm-hmm. Yes. It was only a line, he mentioned just the scheme and not very much more. So I started thinking about that and I thought, that's the proper way of doing using a switching receiver, and in this case, switching frequency is a better thing than switching to a noise source or something like that.
You've been planning to use a Dickey radiometer.
Yes, I already was playing with the idea of changing from total power to some Dickey scheme. I knew the Dickey scheme by then. I had found out in the literature and so on. The way I did it finally was to modify the equipment I had, in that there was a crystal oscillator built, I think that was a contribution, I think from Philips too, yes. It was a crystal oscillator, and so I tried to frequency modulate that crystal oscillator by just hanging a reactance tube across the crystal.
I see.
And I got a shift of something of the order, I think, of 100 kilocycle or so. And found it 150 kilocycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so that worked, and I then built my own low frequency part, phase detector, etc. And I think there were some ideas around from Dicker's work, and also I think I had at that time some information about Jodl bank receiver. So I'm not sure whether that was right at that time, but I think it perhaps already at that time. So I built that, and then put the whole thing together. And the first thing was to check the sensitivity of the receiver, and so by pointing the Wurzburg to the sun. And that worked. There was a raise in intensity and the output of the detector.
Right.
And so I remember that I found Dr. Houtvast. He was the secretary of the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I had got solar radiation coming in, and he was quite enthusiastic. He was at Utrecht, you see, and so he was interested in the sun.
Well, this is
quite excited that at 21 centimeter we were receiving solar radiation.
Well, this is more than 2 years after the forming of the foundation. It was his first positive result,
I guess. Yes.
Yeah. And this is now how long before the line was discovered that you actually
That must have been. Well,
the air.
I discovered a line, I think it was in that spring, 51, within half a year after I came into business.
Right. Well, it was only within a half a year, but how long was it before you went on the air with the sun, before you went to the line? Was that just a week or two?
No. Well, I came there first of December, and then I started doing some studies in the literature and so on, getting acquainted with the techniques. And then at the beginning of the next year, 51, some of the rest of the Philips equipment came in, and so I had something that really could mm-hmm. be a receiver. And then I started changing the equipment. So I think that must have been some March or April or something like
mm-hmm.
that, rather soon before the final discovery of that.
Were there any modifications that you needed to make between the solar detection and the line detection?
No, I think at that time most of the equipment was really already finished. I had one assistant, De Bruyn. He was a good technician, I think, a radio amateur,
mm-hmm.
a very fervent radio ham, really, not a very neat working one, but he managed to do things quickly. And
didn't start fires either.
Didn't start fires either, but he had been with his hole already. So we together did the building. He really did the wiring, most of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember going to Kootwijk in the evening, because during daytime there was too much interference and so on, and it was clear that you could better try for first line reception mm-hmm. during the evening hours.
Even at 21 centimeters?
Even at 21. Well, it probably most of the mess really came in at the IF,
right, in the IF.
And mm-hmm. not at 21 centimeters.
Right.
So there were some difficulties with the mixer, for instance, that you really fed in so much IF power from a local transmitter that you burned crystals and so on. On the other hand, I was very happy that I did this work the first years at Kootwijk at such a difficult site, because I really had to go into problems of shielding mm-hmm. and filtering and so on. And, so I learned how to build a receiver, notwithstanding the fact that some 20 meters from my small shed with which I was working, the end of a large rhombic was sitting, with the second harmonic of its frequency being in my IF band.
Oh, really?
Putting out 30 kilowatts or something like that on the harmonic, or something near 15 or 16 megacycles or so.
This was because the radio astronomy effort was sort of a minor thing as far as the PTQ
yes,
was concerned.
We really used, the Würzburg was put up somewhere between the two fields of transmitters. There was one around the buildings and the other one was somewhat further away and on a hill mm-hmm. lying between those two antenna fields. Würzburg was standing there, and there was a small wooden shed next to it. And there we were working.
But this antenna was not used for other things once you...
No, it was standing there for this purpose only. Really, it was. The Voigt had salvaged it right after the war. It had been standing somewhere at the Dutch coast, and he had really salvaged it from being taken apart by local people and so on, and brought it to...
Is this true of all the antennas at Kootwijk were taken from various different places?
Well, most of them were 10 megacycle or 10 and 30 megacycle.
They weren't
not wire arrays. But these were the two Würzburgs that were salvaged from the many that must have been all along the Dutch coast.
Yeah.
And then he repaired it and made it working again.
While you were developing the receiver, you of course knew about the efforts at Harvard. Did you feel any competition? Or not necessarily in the negative sense, but...
I don't think so, because, I felt that I knew nothing about the thing. And really, I'd only started, really any idea of that I could compete with such people was completely out of my mind at that time.
I think,
No.
But as it was, you were only a couple of weeks behind them or something like that?
Yes, and because the first effort really worked, that was the nice thing.
Was it the first time you looked at the galaxy?
Yes, with a complete receiver. Then I got. We did it this way that I pointed the telescope. I think on the. I'm not sure whether the first observations were on the galactic center, may have been, or on. On Cygnus, those mm-hmm. were the two regions where you could expect.
This is where Oort had determined that most hydrogen.
Yes, that were a few good spots to look at. So I don't know where I really looked at that time, but I went for a couple of minutes. I observed the source, and then I shifted my frequency in the second local oscillator to the other reception frequency where there should be a negative deflection. Mm-hmm. So I. Moved every 5 minutes or so, I moved my frequency from the one frequency where the positive deflection
right.
to the negative, to the other frequency where negative deflection. So I should have expected to see a sort of square wave
right.
Pattern occur.
On a strip chart, I guess.
On a strip chart. There was a Philips strip chart recorder there, and I did the observations on that one. And I think I didn't follow the source, but I had the telescope fixed because there was no following mechanism available. You had to crank everything by hand. There were motors for driving it fast, but not slow. So that was done by just...
So you just went ahead of the source and let it drift through?
I set it before the source and then let it drift through. And I remember that it worked. You saw slowly mm-hmm. see things...
With what sort of signal noise, roughly? I mean,
a few times, I think.
Yeah, just
I probably have some old records.
Well, that would be very interesting to see.
Out of that very first time, I think.
And what was your, what would you estimate was your system temperature?
Oh, it must have been very poor, really, because when I remember the records, and they have been photographed, so they are available there, and I remember the photograph, really, and not the first record itself. But, well, there was a signal to RMS noise in the sickness area, probably it was maybe 10 or something like that.
With a
and then, and on the late two, yes, that was vivid, so the order of 10 seconds or so, something like that, I think.
10 seconds, then?
Yeah, I expect it must have been something like that.
And what was your filter width? I suppose this is in the original paper.
Yeah, I think it's in the neighborhood of 40 kilocycles or something like that.
Okay.
It was a dead order.
So we can work backwards and get
it. Yeah, you can, but if you look at the later records, that was almost noise-free on sickness, so...
Oh, yeah.
It must have been maybe 10,000 degrees or something like that. I didn't understand much about mixers and so on, so...
Well, you don't have to make apologies about the poor system temperature. The idea was to detect the line.
Well, to detect the line, but still, it worked.
That's the important thing.
That's the important thing.
So,
but it was a poor show in the instability and so on, the zero drifted, and but you could, by this switching method of going to 2 to 3 frequencies, you really even saw the zero line had some drift that I couldn't understand at all at that moment. There was a clear indication that there was a signal.
So now what happened when you had the signal? Can you describe what happened in the next few weeks?
I think the... Not very much, really. We did a few scans on sickness and on Sagittarius, I think. And then immediately Oort decided that he was going to publish that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first paper that went jointly with the UN and the later Christians and Hindman paper.
Right.
And after that, I think I said to Oort that this equipment was no good for further observations. This was just too poor. And looking backward, I must say that I think it was a great deed by Oort to say okay, because he had been waiting for 5 years for this, and he really wanted to have more observations, but he accepted that I said it's no good, we have to make better equipment before we really try to build equipment,
right.
And I have to understand what's all happening. And then, after those very preliminary observations, I think I spent a year or so on building a new receiver and trying to understand why there were offsets and what you could do against that. Understanding mixers, for instance, and understanding that zero lines had to do with impedance changes in the antenna and so on, and that it worked through the mixer, and then what sort of matching problems you had and all that sort of thing. And I think that year was a very profitable one, because at the end I had a much better receiver that really could give us good profiles. There was still drift, but we really had in the sickness area the 3 bands. That was quite clear. Sometimes the zero line started there and ended there, and next time it was slightly different.
Yeah.
But by averaging that out, we were quite sure about how the line profile really was.
And this is now, you say, in sort of spring 52.
Must have been in that during 52, I think.
When you went on the air again.
Yeah, when we were.
And your improvements had yielded what sort of effective improvement in system temperature or stability?
I think at least an order or so.
Mm-hmm.
At least, I think. I think at that time we were now in the must have been in the south degree area or something like that. Perhaps even lower, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been 600 or 700. I had some crystals that I was using that were experimental ones from Philips. There was a group there at the physics laboratory who made experimental point contact crystals, which were very good. but not very stable.
Yeah.
But we used a lot of these things, but we had a lot of burnouts because of all these interference from transmitters. If you were not very careful to handle them, then you injected so much burnout energy that the crystals went.
Why couldn't you erect a big screen, so to speak? Or is that just too much?
I think
cost?
That would have been too expensive, and there wasn't one transmitter, but there were a lot around.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you see, also the position was in a way a little bit delicate because we were guests there. We were guests from Mr. De Voogd, and he was in a way he had the supervision of the entire Kootwijk transmission station.
Yeah, I can understand that.
But that were transmitter people and not receiver people at all. So they were quite friendly on a personal basis. But
if you had tried to request too many changes,
if we had suggested very big changes, we should have done it through the vault, and it would have been quite especially if it had interfered with the transmitting service, it would have been sing-sing. So,
which is what the PTT, of course, is main business.
This was the main business of Kootwijk. So, it was clear we could work that telescope, but no interference and no. And they were willing to help us, but on a limited basis.
Right. Yes. Okay, so you got the second receiver working now.
Yeah.
What research was done with that receiver?
I think the first Kootwijk survey was done with that receiver.
So that was over a couple of years, wasn't it?
I don't remember. You really have to look into the papers, I think, to see how long that took. But the very first survey, that first paper by Wout van der Helst and myself, that was based on that receiver. Not very stable, but rather sensitive already, and producing quite good, with a rather broad band. I think it was 40 kilocycles at that time.
And you were still the only engineer?
I was still during the whole period in Kootwijk. I was the only engineer up to, must have been, and that has been quite a long time really. There was later, only in the Dwingelo period, I had an engineer for a couple of years, and then I was alone.
Even after being at Dwingelo?
Yes, after being at Dwingelo. I had a period where I was the only university man at the spot. And then it's only somewhere in the beginning of '60s or so that really second man came up, and then the plans for the there was also a second group in the foundation coming up. That was the group from Charles Seeger. You probably have heard about that one.
Well, I haven't heard about the group per se.
Yes. Seeger was a rather fantastic man.
He's another one I want to talk to.
Yes. Well, he's in the States somewhere, and he was going to build continuum receivers, and his first plan was a 400 megacycle continuum receiver, and but he didn't want to come out to Dwingelo. He wanted to live in university town, and so that group was set up in Leiden. So there were two groups now in the foundation. This, and then already, I think, rather early, the scheme of the large cross really came up.
But now, when was the second group?
I think that must have been somewhere in the neighborhood of 55, 56 or something like that. I'm not sure when Seeger really came to Leiden.
Right.
But it's somewhere around that time, I think. Must have been 55, 56.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Well, I'll talk to him about
that. Yeah, he probably knows.
It just occurred to me that one reason, perhaps, why Dutch radio astronomy concentrated so much on the hydrogen line, at least in the first 10 years, was perhaps that you were the only engineer and that one man can only do so much.
It was a very small affair, really. Right. Yes. It was a very small affair. There was a small group of myself. I finally got one other technician in the Kootwijk, so we were a group of three people there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with those three people and one volunteer boy who was still studying but had had his year of practice and who came from Zwingli, with those two people and him and myself, we went to Zwingli. That was the first group that went to Zwingli, really, four people. So at that time, there wasn't very much happening.
Right, one current receiver and thinking about the next one is enough.
Yeah, and improving on that one, the first receiver was a one-channel receiver. Then we doubled the channel because by this switching scheme in which you had the two channels, sit always one channel on the line and one reference channel on one side or the other side of the line, that gave a root 2 improvement in sensitivity. And but not only that, but also did a lot of balancing on drifts and so on, etc. So that was a good scheme and it worked quite well, and that was, I think, the big Kotwijk, the final Kotwijk survey was done with that two channel receiver. I think in one of the papers you see a publication where you see how the two parts of a record from one channel and the other channel were overlapped and so on.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a good point to ask you about the traditional Dutch separation between the engineering and the scientific side. From your point of view, how do you see this relationship?
Well, there was, of course, at the very beginning, no, not at the beginning, Ho had been working at Kotwijk, and it was in the mind of the foundation quite clear that I should work there too. I think the real discussion on came later in when the transition to Zwingli had to be discussed, and what we should do, whether we should maintain the technical group at the spot, or that I should go to Leiden and
be
direct it from a distance.
Be a part of the Sterrewacht.
Be a part of the Sterrewacht. And there were two reasons, I think, that I chose to stay at the spot. First, I had a feeling that if I really wanted to do a proper job, I had to be there. And I had to know about all the small details that were occurring. And I think that was also partly based on the fact that the post office at that time, where I was a guest at that time, had the sort of arrangement with, for the transmitting station, only a small local group with the large central laboratory at Leidschendam near The Hague. And that didn't work properly, because there were people at the central laboratory. That meant they understood everything that was happening, and that the information didn't come through, etc. So I worried about that, that the same thing would happen and that I would only hear the bad things and the big bad things, but not the small ones, which often are just a clue for... it's often the very small things that give you a clue to that, to further improvements and so on. So I felt I should be on the spot and really live with the equipment and hear exactly from moment to moment what was going to happen. Well, the second reason was, I think, that I'm not a man to live in a big city. So I felt more attracted to living out in the country than go to Leiden.
But maybe I'm wrong. Is this really a traditional Dutch setup, or is this only what's happened in radio astronomy?
No. Well, it's difficult to say whether it's traditional. In this case, the radio telescope had to be away from a large center. It had to be in a quiet spot.
But is it true in many other sciences that a scientist, quote unquote, sort of receives his data? It's taken for him, and then he analyzes the data.
Well, no, I don't think so, because most of the research is being done at the universities. There are not too many field stations.
Okay. So this is sort of unique to us.
It was unique and dictated by the circumstances, I think.
Even an optical astronomy is not true, is it? Because
no.
The man usually goes to the optical telescope.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay, so we're up to the second receiver, and that was the first Kodvak survey.
The second receiver made the first Kodvak survey, and then we probably should go through the BANs to see how the further development has been. I remember there was a two-channel or still a one-channel receiver, but with two IF channels in a balanced configuration. And then later on, second step was to have two separate channels, mm-hmm. each observing the half of the profile to improve the speed again.
Right.
Well, at that time already at other places, they were starting on many channel receivers. I was rather hesitant, I think, at that time to go too fast, because I felt that the equipment speed need not be much faster than the reduction speed. And at that time, really, the reduction speed was a limiting factor in the work.
Well, I think it still is at Westerbork.
Still is at Westerbork, but at that time it was all done by hand, and right. There was a staff of calculators at the observatory, and it was a slow affair, and I think we still had the... we needed, I think, 3 man-hours for 1 hour observing or something like that at that time. So for one, and we operated full time, 24 hours a day.
Mm.
And that's probably another story I should tell you how we did it.
Yes.
Because it was a very, the telescope itself, as I already mentioned, was an instrument which could be moved in a course way with a fast speed. But had no motor drive at all for following the source.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that all by moving the telescope every 2.5 minutes. Lists made for various points in the sky, and we interpolated between the lists. Or perhaps I think already at that time, for the points, the list came from the observatories. And we had student observers who came out to Kodvak. There was the lucky circumstance that there was a hotel at the spot for the post office people.
Right.
Because the post office held there also conferences and so on. It was a lovely area, recreation area, mm-hmm. in Kodvak. And so they could stay at that hotel. And they came for 2 weeks. And then they cranked the telescope all the time. And, did that 7 days a week. On an 8-hour shift, so we had usually 3 people around, each one taking 8 hours, and then the next one, and all they did was really move the telescope every 2.5 minutes.
Amazing.
And then observations took many hours.
No receiver adjustments were necessary?
Yes, also, in the beginning, there was a cavity type of local oscillator multiplier. We first had done it with a crystal oscillator and a multiplier chain ending up in a cavity, and we had improved on that and with better outputs and so on, but it was essentially the same scheme, so we had rebuilt it and so on. But there was a cavity on that oscillator chain, and that was sitting in a box behind the reflector, because we had discovered that flexible cable at 21 centimeter between the dish and the small hut which was mounted on the telescope was no good. So we had all the transport of power between the dish on the low frequency, so that was sent in at the low frequency.
Right.
So the cavity adjustment had to be done in that box, sitting behind the reflector. And the reflector had all sort of elevation positions. So during the night, the observer had to creep out. He had an indication on the meter that his local oscillator, his crystal current, went low. And then he had to climb out. And there, outside the box, was standing a duplicate meter which gave the crystal current. And then he started feeling his way into the on the side of the box where we had an outlet which turned a knob on which mm-hmm. operated the cavity, and that went with jumps and so on. So he carefully had to readjust it until he had the crystal current up again to its almost normal value, and then he climbed back to the
hopefully all within 2 minutes, so he could
yes, and then he had to remove the telescope. And that had to be done during the night. It wasn't too bad usually, because the temperature was rather constant, but during daytime and during sunset and sunrise, temperature shifted quickly, and mm-hmm. you had to make frequent adjustment on that cavity.
But now, what about the actual frequency setting, though? How was that done?
The frequency setting, the original scheme in the very first receiver had been to modulate the a crystal. That gave a small shift, and it was obvious that that shift of the order of 150 kHz was not enough to drive on the... So we had to shift at least one megacycle to be free from the profile with the reference frequency. So that couldn't be done in that way. So we, the post office lab, at that time, I think Mr. Hochhardt, the builder of
the telescopes,
was at that time employed at the post office labs in Leidschendam, and he was in the, he had to do, I think, with the microwave group there,
mm-hmm.
and he built for us, have had built there, two crystal oscillators and a switch, an electronic switch, which could switch between the two crystal oscillators, and that was put in.
I see.
And didn't work properly, it turned out. Because we had curious effects when we put it in, that the profiles became very broad. It was very funny. And I had to do some analysis on that problem, and I found out that the isolation of the switch was no good, and that there was too much leakage from the other crystal oscillator. If you added the two signals, you could translate that into a because of the limiting effects of the multiplier chain behind it, in as a frequency modulated oscillator.
Uh-huh.
So that frequency modulation broadened the profile. So it was clear that we needed a switch which had high isolation, 80 dBs or something like that, and we built our own, I think it was a two-stage switch, and that did the trick.
Mm-hmm.
So then we really switched between two crystal oscillators.
Right.
The calibration of the two frequencies was done by comparing it to a clock signal finally coming in by telephone line from the post office laboratories. We had a substandard to which we compared on the scope by Lisa's U pictures mm-hmm. The two frequencies. That was one of the tasks that the observer had to do. He had a switch which he could pull, and then he had a Lisa's U picture for one frequency, and then swallowing the switch for the other one, and he had to do to set the frequencies of the two crystal oscillators by a 10-turn knob or something like that, so that the Lisa's U picture was almost not moving. It was allowed to move such that you could still see it moving, but when it was a blur, it was obvious that you had to recalibrate it. And that substandard was good enough, and that was by another calibration, actually, was compared to the telephone line, I think, that came in on 1,000 cycles.
And the,
we did all that.
The intensity calibration was the famous looking at the pine forest.
Yes, looking at the pine forest, yes.
And whose idea was that?
That was mine, I think.
Really?
Yes.
That really is the...
It was. Well,
you
see, that was the pleasant thing about the Würzburg was that we could move it to minus 2 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So I could really move in the beam. And the telescope was mounted on the slope of a hill. So by putting it to the north, where the hill was going up, and then really moving it to...